Houston Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. This is hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So in Texas, the head of agriculture, the agriculture commissioner, is putting a new spin on freedom fries by liberating school lunches from healthy restrictions. Though his department is charged with fighting obesity, and by the way, Texas has one of the highest obesity rates for kids in the country, he's choosing to fight a 10-year ban on deep fat fryers. Joining us on the line for his take on this and other bioethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Hey, Art, great to talk to you. Yeah, before we get to the French fry story out of Texas, I want to ask you, as you know, the Tsarnaev, the marathon bomber trial is going on up, the death penalty phase actually is going on up here in Boston. And in the course of this, we've learned from the defense about, and also there was a big article in the New York Times about this, about the Supermax prison where Tsarnaev could end up. And I read the piece in the Times. I heard the lawyer talking about it this week, and I was pretty shocked. Talked about things like, you know, everybody being in solitary confinement 23 mm-hmm. hours a day, basically all the time, because they're not even talking to their fellow prisoners. They may have an hour to kind of be in this cage for some kind of recreation and their food coming through a slot in the door, et cetera, really horrible conditions. And there's a lot of suits out there around mental health, mentally ill prisoners and suicide rates, et cetera. I'm just wondering, Art Kaplan, if you are aware of any action by the medical community to step in some of these places. They're taking the psychotropic drugs away from prisoners who suffer from things like, if psychotropic drugs is the right word, from things like manic depressive, bipolar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is there any involvement in doctors in this whole situation of incarcerating these prisoners in these supermaxes this way?
You know, I haven't heard a ton about it, a little bit. But the problem is this. Execution, the way we're doing it, botching it, not having the right equipment and chemicals and training, clearly many people think is barbaric, even if you are executing murderers and rapists and terrorists and bombers. It still looks inhumane. The Supermax, all the evidence shows, is equally cruel because you go crazy. You can't be alone. And by the way, when you get your hour, you're still alone.
Right.
So you can't put somebody into those conditions. We know what the outcome is. They lose their minds. I've talked to a few people who work with folks in the healthcare role, and they say they're all mentally degenerating. So, again, some of us are going to say, I don't care if the person who blew up the Boston Marathon mentally degenerates. That's too bad. But in our society, what we try not to do is impose barbaric punishment. We don't whip them. We don't stone them. We don't, I think, and shouldn't, waterboard them. And we shouldn't basically drive them crazy. Let me add, if you want to punish them, what's the point of driving them insane? They don't understand what's going on after a while anyway.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Okay.
We're talking to Art Kaplan from NYU. Art, so there's no leadership there. There's clearly leadership in Texas from the agricultural commissioner. I am obsessed with school lunches because I remember all the crap that we ate. There's this guy, Sid Miller, new agriculture commissioner. One of his first moves, apparently, was to grant amnesty to cupcakes. And now what he is doing is he is bringing fryolators, really good for the kids there, attempting to bring fryolators back into the public schools. His quote to the Houston Chronicle, which is great, it's not about French fries, it's about freedom. It's about giving back local control, allowing each school district to make the best decision, I should insert here, to their fat little children. I mean, he doesn't say that amongst the most obese kids, and having been an overweight kid myself, believe me, I know this. I don't have the science in front of me, but I know that if you're an overweight kid, the likelihood is good you're going to be an overweight adult. A huge part of the diet of young kids is school lunches. Where are we in terms of what I thought was the direction we were going nationally, maybe we still are, to healthier and healthier school lunches? What's going on with that?
Yeah, slowly. I wouldn't say we're rushing toward healthier school lunches. Slowly. People are trying to get more vegetables in. I assume this guy is the agricultural commissioner for the fructose industry, the oil industry. That must be what he grows. But it's obviously a bad decision because you certainly can impose standards for health if you're going to have the school lunch program. I don't think local control is important at all. For some, you know, local control gets a lot of praise, and we sort of celebrate it and cheer it, but you don't need it when it comes to school lunches. You can say, I don't know what the locals think. Maybe the locals want to eat every day at Dairy Queen, which is a big Texas chain, but it's not good for the kids, and we're going to set some standards that basically say here is nutritious food, and that's what we're going to try and teach. I think local control is limited, although I know where I'm going here, but you don't let them teach arithmetic using an abacus. You know, there are standards that get set, and I'm well aware that Texas is fighting the evolution thing, so don't email me. I know. But I think, again, you set your standards at the state level. I think that's the appropriate level to do it, and he shouldn't be heading in that direction. Speaking of which, just at the same time, didn't I just see a law in Missouri that said we ought to not let welfare recipients buy steak? So, you know, at one end of the
spectrum. Is that serious, by the way?
Is that I didn't know that.
I didn't know. Okay, go ahead.
Now, how many welfare recipients can buy steak on the food stamp budget
not very many.
And not starve to death?
Yeah.
Bad, but we're in a little bit of the, I don't know, war on the poor kind of thing, I think, is what's going on here. People don't want welfare recipients to get fancy foods or takeout foods or prepared foods or steak. Kids ought to be free to gorge themselves on whatever junk food the local budget can get away with cheaply, because no one cares really about those kids. There's something nasty about this whole, what we're going to do to people who rely on the school lunch program or welfare. And you can see it in these dietary machinations gussied up, in the case of Texas, with the value of freedom. Freedom?
Yeah.
The kid's six. The kid's 10. He doesn't have any freedom. He eats what you give him. So you got to look out for him.
Well, you often wonder whether some of this is a backlash against Michelle Obama's effort, you know, his politics.
Maybe, yeah.
If Texas is not keen, or this particular guy is not keen on Michelle Obama telling people what they should be serving for lunch, or he doesn't like President Obama.
Well, Texas
Obama
can't be too
like
keen, because remember, too, the governor just issued an order yesterday for the National Guard to keep an eye on the federal army. They're doing exercises in Texas, and he wants to make sure they don't attack Texas, try to take it over. Did you see that?
No, we missed that one, too.
No, gosh, Art, we're glad I talked to you. Keep up to date in the news.
That's right. I'm forget those news divisions at NPR. Just call me every day, and I'll tell you what the heck's going on.
Well, let's move on to something that you probably are in favor of, I would guess, although we don't know if the governor out there in Hawaii is going to sign this bill. But a bill passed the state legislature that would raise the smoking age from 18 to 21. I assume, Art, you think that's a good idea, or maybe you don't.
I do think it's a good idea. I think that generally we know that smoking is really bad for you, and the earlier you start, the worse it is for you. Again, some people are going to say, look, it's just going to drive it underground, and kids will sneak off to the boys' room and bum their cigarettes, and there'll be an underground trade in cigarettes and all that sort of stuff. But I think the message is what I care about. Whether it stops kids from smoking who are intent on smoking, I doubt. But it does sort of get you to think. The reason they're telling you not to start smoking until 21 is it can't be very good for you.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with the message. I don't know that it's going to really drive behavior. I'm a little skeptical there.
You know, I have to say, my attitude is they shouldn't raise it to 21. They should raise it to 81. But that is a whole other thing. I have a real smoking thing. But how do you respond? We've had this discussion, Marjorie and I, through the years a million times, you know, that the Amethyst Initiative, the college president starting at Middlebury, want to lower the drinking age to 18 because they think if you learn at that age, you're less binge drinking. Hawaii and other places want to raise the smoking age to 21. The only argument that always stops me in my tracks is an 18-year-old is old enough to go fight for our country, kill people, and be killed. But he or she is not old enough to make a responsible choice about whether or not they smoke a cigarette or have a drink. Can you give me a better answer to that than I have?
Well, I think the public health message on the age thing about smoking is just a public health message. It really isn't intended to drive a big dent in smoking behavior, because if you want to get cigarettes and you're under 21, you will 100%, no problem. People get them at 14. People get them at 13. I don't really think that is the issue. I think it's kind of the message. So I just take it as a be careful here. This stuff is really bad for you. And I'm kind of leaning where you do. You know, I'm a little puzzled that we haven't made nicotine and smoking under FDA control and treat them like a dangerous drug. We certainly plenty of evidence that it's not good for you. But if it gets grandfathered in, and that's just sort of the way it is, all you can do is try to discourage it. But how long would it take you to find a pack of cigarettes if you were a determined 14-year-old?
But on the issue you just mentioned, this is going to be a borderline moronic statement, but I'll make it anyway. Politics aside.
And you've got the right listener, right?
Well, here it is, right. Politics aside, that's the moronic part. If there wasn't one of the most powerful industries in the country, the tobacco industry, wouldn't cigarettes be treated just like you described?
Yes. That was the shortest answer I've ever given the history of our conversation.
It's only because they own Congress, essentially.
They own Congress. There are a bunch of states that grow tobacco. Right. They got a vested interest in it. It's all money. It's got nothing to do with much of anything else.
One last thing about this. How are we doing? I know that with the early smoking cessation efforts, for example, in Massachusetts, the allegedly anti-tax electorate voted to raise the cigarette tax in 1994, all the money earmarked for smoking cessation programs, and as always happens, some of that, if not all of it, I'm not up to speed on it, has been diverted. There was great progress being made in the early days of the anti-smoking movement, education effort. Is it leveling off? How are we doing in terms of discouraging our fellow citizens from smoking ever?
We did a big drop, and it's been holding steady, but there's kind of I'm going to get the number wrong, but it's like 22-24% of us still smoke, and that number hasn't been dropping, and kids are still picking it up. The big battle, you guys know this, is over vaping and e-cigarettes.
Yeah.
Are they gateway, or are they alternatives, or do they help you stop? I don't think the data is in on that, so we don't know. But that's where the fight has shifted.
And it's a class issue as well. I think it's far more poor people smoke than wealthy people. Lisa.
Smoking and drinking, the ads tend to go to poor neighborhoods.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. Art, I want to ask you, we've talked about this several times, but this Henry Rahans, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right. He's an older guy, 78 years old, married to his wife Donna in their 70s, hadn't been married that long. He was on trial, thankfully he was acquitted, from my perspective anyway, for on sexually abusing his wife charges because his wife had Alzheimer's disease and he'd been accused of having sex with her in a nursing home after being told that she was too ill with Alzheimer's to consent. He was acquitted, gave an unbelievably, and if he's to believed, poignant interview to the New York Times, basically talking about, denying actually that he ever actually had sex, that he was cuddling with her. But I know that...
By the way, Marjorie, he never said he didn't ever have sex with her. He just said the day they busted me, I didn't have sex with her.
But the reason I'm asking you about this yet again, there was a lot of concern in the medical community that Alzheimer's is a big problem, and what do you do about being able to consent to sex if someone is having difficulty mentally with their whole day? But I wonder what this acquittal will mean in terms of nursing homes and others that deal with Alzheimer's patients. Again, bringing charges against someone that, in their estimation, has violated the rules. I mean, where are we now with this?
Supermax, solitary. No more problems there, right?
Yeah. But I mean, it does seem to me this guy was wrongly brought before the court.
Look, it's ridiculous to bring this guy to court. Absurd, ridiculous, screwy, nuts, bad. What's he doing there in a third-degree felony charge? He's not a threat. Really, to anybody else, he needs a family meeting. If you want to sort of control what he does when he visits, you could have him supervised. You could get an agreement that he can cuddle. You could work it out with a little bit of a family meeting. Something's wrong in that situation. I don't know. Maybe the kids from the first marriage don't like him touching their mom.
Right.
I don't know what's going on, but it should never be a felony charge in a court. If that's the best we can do, that stinks.
I should have said it happened in Iowa. This is it, so maybe. Things,
why should you have said it happened?
Well,
in
because
Iowa?
maybe things are different in Iowa. I don't
what
know.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
They're tough on married couples in Iowa.
Apparently.
Secondly, we have had, although we don't use it much, there is something called the psychiatric living will, which is for people who know they're slipping or know they periodically go in and out of mental illness. For example, let's use Jim. So if Jim was going into his usual schizophrenic episode and was incoherent for a while, you can fill in the blanks, listeners. we might ask him to fill in a living will before that happened and say, still give me my medications, even if when I'm in my nutty state, I say don't do it. And that's fine. And I don't see why we don't do that if we could get over the ickiness of trying to talk about sex with old people. Why don't we do that when the couple is still, she's still kind of with it, and they're going to enter the home, and you can sort of say, in this home, we permit contact. Is that something you would want? Do you want that even if you're very demented? What kind of privacy do you have here? It's something, by the way, that you also need to ask if your parents are going into an institution. What if they're married and they want to have sex and they're not demented? I mean, their places aren't necessarily set up to let them do that.
Yeah, that's a great question. That is a great question.
I've even had a few people, I know this is horrific for many to think about, but find a new friend in the nursing home,
yes,
and they're both competent, and, you know, what are you going to do? Hang your Depends on the doorknob and say, don't come in here? I mean...
It's a very romantic thought, I should say. With the proper lighting, I think that'd be great.
If they're having all that great sex, they don't need Depends. You know, they're having great elderly sex and things are working. That would be wonderful.
So, Art Kaplan, you said that shouldn't be a felony, what the guy out there in Iowa was doing. Something that you wrote about that maybe should be a felony, the title of your piece for Forbes.com, Chinese scientists try to alter genomes in human embryos. Even before I read the piece, I was freaked out. And then when I read it, I was more... Describe what's going on and what your concerns are, please.
So there's a new technique for modifying DNA. It's called CRISPR. And I'm not going to get everybody lost in the details, but what it is like a giant scissors, and you can snip DNA at exact locations and put in something else, so you can really get a lot of changes in your DNA all at once. Before, when we use something called gene therapy, which listeners will know I've yakked about in the past, you're kind of targeting a particular gene and making one change. Now you got this thing that lets you really make a lot of changes all at once. So it just appeared. It's only been around a couple years. It's, by the way, the technique that people talk about when they want to bring back the woolly mammoth, you know, that discussion, resurrecting animals that have gone extinct.
Yep.
Oh, that's out in Iowa, right?
No, that's actually right in your backyard. It's Harvard.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Not that the woolly mammoth would run around at Harvard,
yeah,
but
of course,
they'd probably send him out to Framingham where I was. But the I don't remember where I was talking. Oh, yeah. So we engineering the genes all at once, and you could do it with an embryo. So you could try to change the embryo. That crosses two lines. One, you're changing genes that would be inherited by children. All this genetic engineering we've heard about to the present involves changing genes in Marjorie, but it just is in her body, and she doesn't pass them on. Now, if you do it in an embryo, it's going to go on for future generations. The changes will be there, and that crosses line two, which is, are we going to start enhancing our embryos? Stronger, faster, taller, gabbier, whatever traits that people want, because you don't have to just go in there and treat diseases. What the Chinese group did was they said, we want to be first. They grabbed a bunch of human embryos. They did this editing technique. They actually produced nothing of any interest because I don't think they know how to use it properly, but they published it in a very obscure paper, thereby leading me to say, you know what? Hey, why don't we have a timeout? Why don't we come up with some rules about when this should be done or who should do it or what the penalties are if you do it and you do it for some bad purpose. We still do have a little time. The Chinese paper scientifically was not very interesting, and that's why it didn't appear in any major journal. But the ethical issues are here right now. Time to start talking about them.
Well, isn't the good news, I guess, in that monologue there of yours was that they're not quite there scientifically, but once they are, assuming they are, isn't the genie out of the bottle here? I mean, I assume if a place like the United States found this to be unethical, then somebody who wanted a designer baby and then babies beyond just goes somewhere else and has this done, right?
You could, although you need a lot of competent people to do this. You can't just have one nut in a desert island kind of thing to do it. So you could control it a little bit by saying, one, if you don't have approval from some international body, you're not going to get published. Well, believe me, scientists hate that. The frontline guys are like, oh, not published. Well, not going to do that. Hard to get grants. You can make money tough. I won't say that there aren't private people who might fund something, but you can make it tougher. And then you could put some real penalties on there. You say you did it, you could go to jail. You announce, you know, here's little Art. He's a very good pitcher, and we designed him for that. And somebody says, hey, that's really interesting, and it's Supermax time for you. I'm obsessed with the Supermax here. But you could put penalties in that are real. Could you enforce them in North Korea? I don't know, but it's better to have penalties than nothing.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist extraordinaire from NYU. One last thing before we get to the Everyday Ethics podcast. There's a piece in the Times that is troubling to me on two fronts. Let me read one sentence. The president has asked Congress to let Medicare officials negotiate prices with drug manufacturers, a practice explicitly forbidden by current law. And I would like you to explain the rationale for that in a moment. I assume it's because of the power of the drug companies.
I can do that right now. Drug companies like to make money.
Okay, and so essentially they drafted the law that says it is I mean, when you step back for a second and say Medicare is statutorily precluded from trying to negotiate a better price with drug manufacturers is surreal to me. But that is what it is.
It's surreal to me.
Okay.
So if you're a free marketeer, you want to sit there and say, I can't negotiate a price. I can do it with a car. I could do it with a beachfront house. I could do it with any number of things, but I'm forbidden by law, if I run the Medicare system, to negotiate prices on drugs, or for that matter, devices, or for that matter, anything else, because what?
Because the drug companies told me not to. But that relates to the second thing that I think where there's some optimism. This I didn't know the term that was being used for these personalized therapies is precision medicine. And this notion, you treat illnesses like cancer, cystic fibrosis, et cetera, with these therapies that are developed specifically for an individual. That's the good news that that's happening. The bad news is some of these treatments are $50,000 to $100,000 to $300,000 a year. And that's why it's in the same piece, because of the desire on the Obama administration to allow Medicare to negotiate prices of drugs so those can come down. Where are we on that? I mean, one of the worst things, we've discussed this in other contexts with you, is the good news, we've entered an age where science is such that we can develop a therapy targeted to you, which means it's much more likely to be successful. That's the good news. The bad news is 99.9% of America can't afford it. Where are we on the affordability issue?
Right there, still unsolved, really not getting any traction. Listeners will know a new drug came out for hepatitis C, works pretty well, probably costs $100,000 for each round of treatments. The VA, for example, has a lot of people with hepatitis C in there. They can't fund it. They're having arguments about how sick do you have to be before you can start them on the drug. Medicaid programs in many states are saying we can't pay for this. We're nowhere. And it is a scandal that people keep saying we have to raise the age for Medicare eligibility. I think certain politicians have been talking that way without getting at the price issue. Why does it cost so much? Where are the hearings on that? So if you want to have a market drive the delivery of health care, you got to let the market operate by letting the people who pay negotiate prices down. And if you don't do that, then you got a monopoly. And I don't think that is cheap.
Art Kaplan, co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. What is the Everyday Ethics Podcast today?
Sports safety. A lot of baseball players are wearing these donut things around their heads and big guards around their faces to protect themselves.
Huh.
Getting a lot of flack from some of the old-timers. Sissies, not manly. I didn't wear that when I was a kid. Is that really the right response? Is it dumb to wear protective gear, or is
really?
It dumb to complain about it?
Where are these baseball players playing baseball?
In the pros, the guy for the relief pitcher for the Mets came out recently with his baseball cap surrounded by a big donut so that if someone hit a ball back at him, he wouldn't get his head smashed. Stanton, I guess he plays for the Dodgers, has long face guards that he's introduced. He lost a season last year by getting hit in the face.
Oh, he's the guy, the guy from Miami.
Marlin.
Yeah,
that's right,
yeah.
Marlin.
Best hitter in baseball, theoretically. Yeah.
And so I'm all for this. You know, safety is great, and I think it should be fashionable.
Wow. And people are calling them sissies. I love it.
Can I tell you something, Art? When I was younger, I used to wear a donut on my head all the time, by the way. Just a different kind. It's a long... You and I can discuss that off the air. Art, it's great to talk to you as always.
You want to be in touch with the Texas Agricultural Commissioner.
Art, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Art.
I know.
Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center and also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. He joins us every week. Okay, coming up, Today marks the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, a war that's responsible for a generation of war veterans. We'll find out what the new Massachusetts Secretary of Veterans Services is doing to help them and other vets. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.